you would this morning, turn with me to the 32nd chapter of the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 32. I want to take one more week off from our series and return to that after our meeting. So I'd like to look at an account in the life of Jeremiah that is quite interesting, that as literally the Babylonians are besieging Jerusalem, God sends a message to Jeremiah about something he's to do in the midst of this siege. And sometimes God has called his children in the Bible to do things that seem so contrary to what was going on in their circumstances. But a lot of times if they would yield and obey, they would see either a great powerful deliverance that particular moment, or it would be a picture of a promise to come, which is the case here in Jeremiah chapter 32. This chapter really deals with the sovereignty of God in delivering his children. If you were to ask me what's my favorite subject of the Bible, of course, depending on my emotions at the moment, that could shift, but I think if you had to really nail me down, it would be God's sovereignty. And the reason being is that everything about God and everything that we receive of him is all dependent upon him being an all-powerful God with all authority. Him being the creator is dependent on him being sovereign. Him being our redeemer is dependent on him being sovereign. Him being our helper, as we saw last week in the case of Samuel and the experience we looked at there, is dependent on him being sovereign over the things of this world. And when we say that God is all-powerful, he's sovereign, it does not mean that God is the one who is the author of evil or sin. We don't believe that at all. And we don't believe that God is orchestrating every event that transpires on the earth. But we also do need to be mindful that he superintends all things. That means he is over all things. There's nothing that escapes his notice, and there's nothing outside of his intervening power. He could step in every instance if he so chose to do so. So I never want to go so far in speaking on the sovereign power of God to indicate to a child of God that I believe that he's orchestrating everything that's going on, good or evil. I do not believe that. I believe that, in fact, is blasphemous. But at the same time, I don't want to give the idea that I'm a deist that makes you think that maybe God's just not involved, because there is a balance in between. When we say that God is sovereign, it means he superintends his creation. You know, a school superintendent, they have the responsibility to be the ultimate person in authority in charge, but that does not mean that they're making every single decision, every single movement, every single action. The superintendent of Hillsborough County Schools can't be in every building in Hillsborough County, can't be in every classroom, can't be the voice for every teacher, but at the end of the day, he or she, I don't know if it's male or female superintendent right now, they are responsible for that school district. And so God ultimately is the one who is in charge and responsible. Now, when I say responsible, that does not mean that he's charged with wicked, but he is ultimately the one who is in charge of this world. And thank God that is the truth. So it says, the word that came to Jeremiah, this is chapter 32, from the Lord in the 10th year of Zedekiah, king of Judah, which was the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar. For then the king of Babylon's army besieged Jerusalem, and Jeremiah the prophet was shut up in the court of the prison, which was in the king of Judah's house. So Zedekiah is the last king that is going to reign in Jerusalem outside of the reign of Babylon. There'll be puppet kings after him, but he's going to be the final one. Now he's in prison right now because he had been told by, or Jeremiah's in prison because he told Zedekiah that he was going to be overtaken by the Babylonians. He did not like hearing that. Now, whether he liked it or not, the fact is, at that present moment, the Babylonians were surrounding the city. In fact, later it will go on to let us know that their mounts, that means their mounds, their ditches and so forth, were presently dug. The city was under siege at that present hour. So here is a city under siege. Just imagine. So Jerusalem, that's a walled city, has ditches that have been dug all around it, all sorts of earthen works been set up by the Babylonians. So you have the Babylonians on the outside, no one can get in or out. Then you have the walls of Jerusalem. Then you have Jeremiah in prison in Jerusalem. He's almost in a double prison here. He's a prisoner not only of Zedekiah the king, but also of Nebuchadnezzar from Babylon. And of all times to be in prison. And amazing, I would think that if I were king and what was unfolding had been told to me about a prophet from God, and I'm watching it unfold when I go out to the city walls, I think I would go let him out of prison and say, what do we do? Obviously, you were able to anticipate what was coming. Can you tell us how we're supposed to? But God had already made Jeremiah aware that what was happening to the city of Jerusalem was unalterable. It was not going to change. This was a fixed judgment, and it was not going to be altered. In fact, in the early portions of the book of Jeremiah, Jeremiah was told by God not to even pray for that people. Now, that obviously the context is, don't pray that I am going to alter my sentence that these people are going away into judgment. That's fixed. That's not going to change. I've already determined it. They've been unfaithful to me for 490 years, and so they are going to spend 70 years in bondage because of it. So it says, the king of Babylon has besieged Jerusalem, and Jeremiah the prophet was shut up in the court of the prison, which was in the king of Judah's house. For Zedekiah, king of Judah, had shut him up, saying, wherefore dost thou prophesy and say, thus saith the Lord, behold, I will give this city into the hand of the king of Babylon, and he shall take it. And Zedekiah, king of Judah, shall not escape out of the hand of the Chaldeans, meaning the Babylonians, but surely be delivered into the hand of the king of Babylon, and shall speak with him mouth to mouth, and his eyes shall behold his eyes, which actually happened. He says, he shall lead Zedekiah to Babylon, and there shall he be until I visit him, saith the Lord. Though ye fight with the Chaldeans, ye shall not prosper. So it says, Jeremiah said, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying. So here he is in prison for once again telling Zedekiah this is what's going to happen. It says, behold, Hanamel, the son of Shalom, thine uncle, shall come unto thee, saying, buy thee my field that is in Anathoth, for the right of redemption is thine to buy it. So Hanamel, just like God said, came to Jeremiah in prison and says, I want you to buy this for thyself. He says in verse 8, then I knew that this was the word of the Lord. Now, interesting. The cities, in fact, the very city that he's supposed to buy land in is now under the control of the Babylonians. They've already taken that city. It's outside of Jerusalem. They've already conquered it. And now his first cousin comes to him and says to him, I want you to buy a field. It's in your right for redemption. Buy it. Now, if I was in prison, please don't come to me about a real estate exchange. But you know, interestingly enough, I'm working with a fellow agent right now that has literally had to go to the prison to work with an individual to try to purchase real estate from them. And so as she's told me about some of that experience, I've thought to this about here's Jeremiah. You know, if I'm in prison, please come visit me. You know, the Lord says at the last day that that's one of the things he will commend the children of God for is that when he was prisoned, we came and visited him. So if I were ever imprisoned wrongly, please come and see me. But when you do, don't ask me to buy something, okay? Just come and say, Brother Chris, we're praying for you. We're here for you. We're thinking about you. Don't ask me to buy something. But anyway, that's not the case for Jeremiah. Jeremiah is asked to buy. He says, you have the right of redemption. Now, it's very likely there might have been somebody who was a nearer kinsman that had the right to buy. But either way, here God tells Jeremiah that your cousin is going to come. He's going to offer you a particular field in the land of Benjamin. He says, and when he does, you're to purchase it. Now, if it were you and your nation was under siege and you knew that for 70 years your nation was going to be carried away, the land would lie in waste, would you buy that property? I don't think that I would. But you know, one of the things just even in my short time on earth that I have watched unfold is that when calamity is happening financially in our nation, when prices are falling and the market is dropping, there are certain people wise enough in those moments to step in and they purchase. In 08, there were some very wise people. There were some folks that realized, yes, property, the price was dropping out of the bottom. So you know what they were doing? They were taking whatever cash they had and they were buying up every property they could.
And now in 2023, and we look back, I wish I had a lot more money in 2008 and I could have done the same thing. Because an individual that had bought enough property would have been very wealthy. In fact, when I was working for the previous company, I was dealing with a man in St. Pete, and he told me that when that happened, he took every dime that he had out of every retirement investment, and he ended up with over 100 properties in Pinellas County. Imagine an individual with over 100 properties in Pinellas County, what that person would be worth now in 2023. Some people might have thought he was crazy back at the time, but obviously it's proved out to be an extremely wise decision. Well, anyway, here is Jeremiah told to purchase land. Well, in just a natural sense, it's a wise decision to make. I'm sure he got it at a better price than he would have if everything was prosperous in the nation right then. But that is not primarily the reason that he's to purchase this land. He makes the purchase. He does everything according to the law and the custom of the law. They sign the deed. He gives the silver. And one of the deeds is sealed. And that's going to be put in an earthen vessel to be buried, to be kept in safety. And it's not seen by anybody. It's a private transaction. But also there was to be an aspect of that that was public for all to see. And so he follows the custom of the law to the letter. And so he does exactly what God commands him to do. And this is what he says in verse 13. He says, I charge Barak before them, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, take the evidences, this evidence of the purchase, both which is sealed and this evidence which is open, and put them in an earthen vessel that they may continue many days. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, houses and fields and vineyards shall be possessed again in this land. God has just told Jeremiah, y'all are coming back. Yes, it is true that right now you're besieged by Babylon. And even Jeremiah, who knew the promise of God that they were going to be conquered, God had also told Jeremiah that it was a very determinate amount of time. It was a very fixed amount of time that they would be away from home. It was 70 years. Now, if I was told I would be gone for 70, of course, I'm almost 43, I would figure I'm not going to make it back. So if this purchase was offered to me, I think, well, I'll go ahead and buy it. I'll will it to my children. They'll have it for the time when the people come back to the land. And that's probably the case for Jeremiah. But anyway, here God makes it clear to them. And he's using this experience of Jeremiah purchasing this property as part a token of his promise that they would once again come back. Now, how can God make such a promise? Because he's a God that's sovereign. He has all power. And he knew exactly what was going to unfold. As he would say in Jeremiah chapter 29, he says, I know the thoughts that I think toward you, thoughts of peace and not of evil, saith the Lord. He says, to give you an expected end. And that expected end, obviously, was to come back to the land of Israel, which they did. Anyway, verse 16 says, now when I delivered the evidence of the purchase unto Barak the son of Neriah, I prayed unto the Lord, saying, Ah, Lord God. Now when you first read this prayer, in the opening of the prayer, you think, well, Jeremiah's right where he needs to be. I mean, he said everything he should have said up to this point. He's done everything that he was supposed to do. He obeyed what God commanded. And he said, you know, God has said to me that we're going to come back and possess this land. But now he prays. So that's what happens openly. And there's times that you and I can be very confident in the things we say. And maybe even in the things we do shows forth great confidence, but yet down in the depths of our soul, perhaps we're questioning the Lord and questioning what's going on. Have you ever been there? I certainly have. There's been times that I was trying to do exactly what the Bible told me to do. I was trying to say the things that I was supposed to say, but yet there was a trembling heart within me wondering, is this really going to unfold like I just said it's going to unfold? That's where Jeremiah is. He says, ah. The word ah means alas or oh no. In other words, why did I just do this? He says, ah, Lord God, behold, thou hast made the heaven and the earth by thy great power and stretched out arm. And there is nothing too hard for thee. Again, as you read the prayer, you think, well, he's got it down pat. He does, but the problem is he has revealed his heart in the very first word of this prayer. In the very first utterance before God, he lets us know that he has a trembling heart that is doubting God right now. And God's response to his prayer will indicate that as well. He says, "Ah, Lord God," or "Alas," or "Oh no." And so then he says, "Behold, thou hast made the heaven and the earth by thy great power and stretched out arm, and there is nothing too hard for thee." Now, there are times that I can say that, and I think when I say it, I believe it, except I may not believe it in my particular experience that I'm going through in that moment. I know, God, you're able. You made the heaven and the earth. You stretched it out with your arm. You stretched out your arm, and here it is, and there's nothing too hard for you. But, and that's kind of where Jeremiah is. There's nothing too hard for you, but. Have you ever been in that situation? So I just mentioned earlier in the prayer request that I flew to Dallas this weekend. I flew on Thursday morning, flew back. It was supposed to be yesterday morning. Ended up getting in a little later than expected. But anyway, everything went well. I hate this. When I get on, I don't like to fly. I will, but I don't enjoy it. I never am comfortable. And so, and I wish they just sometimes wouldn't say this, but the pilot gets on Thursday morning and says, "Folks, we're going to have some bumpy time as we get out of Tampa. And when we get out over the Gulf, it should smooth out, and then we'll have a smooth flight on into Dallas." Just don't tell me that. Because now here I am sitting at the gate thinking, you know what, that door's still open. I got time. I could still get off of this thing. Just don't tell me, close the door, let's take off. If it's bumpy, it's bumpy. If it's not, it's not. Well, in Dallas, you know what they tell us there? It says, "Folks, we're about to taxi out the runway. It's going to be bumpy till we get up to cruising altitude. So I know for about the first 30 minutes, it's going to be bumpy." Well, it was bumpier longer than that. But anyway, it wasn't bad. I mean, it was very, very mild. But as Thursday morning, particularly yesterday, I was too tired. I didn't care that if that plane went down, it was fine because I was so tired. But on Thursday, I wasn't so tired. And so I started praying. And I know the Lord is able. I have no doubt about that. And it always comes back to this for me. And I think I know I've said this before. My issue with God typically is not his ability. It's very rare that that's ever my doubt. But where I struggle is his willingness. I know he's able, but is he going to be willing? And I don't know. And we never really can for certain know how willing he is in our daily experience. Now, I know he's willing that every child of God will be born of the Spirit. That's going to happen. I know that he is willing that my body is going to come forth from the grave. I know that. I don't worry about that. But when I'm sitting on a plane and the pilot tells me it's going to be real bumpy till we get out somewhere, I'm not sure how willing God is to help me out. And so, and there's a lot of bumpiness in our lives. And we wonder, God, are you willing? Now, here, Jeremiah, he confesses that God is the creator. He says, "You made this world and the earth, the heaven." He says, "By thy great power, thou stretched out arm." And it is important, I believe, for the child of God to keep in memory the creative power of God. It's not accidental that the Bible often refers to the God of creation, because it ought to bolster the confidence of the child of God to know that this very earth upon which we live, that, by the way, hangs on absolutely nothing. Have you ever thought about that? I mean, this earth is literally suspended in space, hanging upon nothing. But the Bible also says it's in the palm of his hand. And so I just trust. Of course, experience shows me that it keeps on moving. Things keep on happening. But God is the God of creation. He spoke this world into existence by his power. And then obviously, as it says in the book of Hebrews, he upholds all things by the word of his power. So we talk about the creative power of God, his sovereign power to make this world. And if he can make this world and by him all things consist, he keeps it together. And if he's concerned about even the smallest details of this creation out here, certainly we ought to always keep in memory that God is, when I say concerned, that means he's paying attention to even the smallest issues of our life. And so while it may sometimes seem ludicrous, like for me to say on Thursday, I was a little concerned when the pilot says what he did, and you say, "Well, brother," and I know as I'm thinking to myself about that, I know that I was in much more danger, statistically speaking, on my drive from Nichols Road to the Tampa airport than I am on that plane. I know that. But the difference is when I'm in my vehicle and I'm holding onto the steering wheel, I'm under the false illusion that I'm in control. And now when I step on that airplane, I have just handed over control to somebody else. Well, the reality is I'm not in control in either situation. And again, it may seem, well, brother, that's so silly. Well, it may be silly, but that's where I was Thursday. And so I was having a few little doubts. And I think if you're honest with yourselves, you probably hardly go through a day where you don't have some. And so it's good to be reminded that God not only is sovereign in creation, sovereign in redemption, but also in helping us in our experiences every day that we live. And so Jeremiah, he says, alas, oh no. And then he goes, I know you made heaven and earth. Nothing's too hard for thee. Thou showest loving kindness unto thousands, and recompensest the iniquity of the fathers into the bosom of their children after them. The great, the mighty God, the Lord of hosts is his name. Great in counsel and mighty in work. For thine eyes are open upon all the ways of the sons of men, to give everyone according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doings, which has set signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, even unto this day, and in Israel and among other men, and has made thee a name as at this day. He says, you brought forth thy people Israel out of the land of Egypt with signs and with wonders and with a strong hand and with a stretched out arm and with great terror, and hast given them this land which thou didst swear to their fathers to give them, a land flowing with milk and honey. And they came in and possessed it, but they obeyed not thy voice. He says, verse 24, behold the mounts. That word mount there literally means the mounds. He's saying, look at the earthen works of the Babylonians. He says, behold the mounts. They are coming to the city to take it. And the city is given in the hands of the Chaldeans. They fight against it. He's acquainting God. God, you've just made me buy this land. I've done what you told me to do. But look, we're being besieged right now. Now, Jeremiah shouldn't have been surprised by that. He's been saying all along that this was going to happen, and now that it's happening, he's saying, God, look, this is happening. Is that not kind of contradictory? I mean, he's been telling the king, he's in prison for telling the king this, and now he's saying, God, I want you to look. Well, God already saw that. God knew that, but, you know, there's times that I do the same thing. God, I need you to look at what's going on here. I need you to see this. I need you to understand. I need you to comprehend as though I could acquaint him with anything. Obviously, I cannot. He already knows, as the Bible says, our needs before we ask, although we're still required to ask. But he says, behold the mounts that are come unto the city to take it, and the city is given into the hand of the Chaldeans that fight against it because of the sword and of famine and of the pestilence. Now, can you imagine what things were like in the city of Babylon? We often talk about 70 AD and how things were there, but imagine, he's just talked about, here we are, under the sword, famine, and pestilence. So people have died in battle. People have died from hunger, famine. They've died from pestilence. Let hunger take over a city, and let a city forget all about its cleanliness, and all of a sudden, pestilence is going to take over the place. They're not able to bring fresh supplies in, and so no town. How disgusting this place has become. And so here now, the children of Israel are not only dealing with the sword, they're dealing with hunger, they're dealing with disease. And here they're having to face all these things. And he says, and what thou hast spoken is come to pass, and behold, thou seest it. And thou hast said to me, O Lord God, buy thee the field for money and take witnesses, for the city is given to the hand of the Chaldeans. All this is happening. You've told me to do this. I don't understand. How many times are you right there? Lord, you told me to do this, I'm doing it, but I just don't understand. That's where Jeremiah is. I've done everything you said to do, and everything you said was going to happen has happened. And I want you to look at it, and I want you to see it. It says, then came the word of the Lord unto Jeremiah, saying, behold, I am the Lord, that means Jehovah, the self-existing eternal one. He says, behold, I am the Lord, the God of all flesh. What does that mean? He says, I'm the God of all living. That means I'm the God of the Israelites, but I'm also the God of the Babylonians as well. In this sense, now, while they may not have been his chosen nation, they were still his creation, and as such, he was the God over them. maybe not the God of love over them, but he's still the God of authority over them. He says, here I am, the God of all flesh. I'm the God of all living. And then God says, is there anything too hard for me? Now, didn't Jeremiah start the prayer that way? He says, I know that there's nothing too hard for thee. And so now God responds with the question, is there anything too hard for me? Why does he ask that question? Jeremiah has already affirmed that in his prayer because he affirmed it in a way of doubt. And there's been times that I have said the very same thing. I know there's nothing too hard for God, and yet I'm saying it with a doubtful spirit. And so now God comes back to Jeremiah, sort of like he did with Job, and put Job on the carpet and said, gird yourself up like a man and give answer. And so now here's Jeremiah. He's prayed to God. He's confessed that he's confused. He tries to acquaint God with what's going on. And then now he says to Jeremiah, the Lord, I am the Lord. Interesting how he starts. I am Jehovah. You know, there's times I simply need to remember that. I just need to remember he's Jehovah. Step one. Jehovah means the self-existing eternal one. When you see in the Old Testament, all capital L-O-R-D, that means Jehovah. When you see capital L, lowercase O-R-D, that means Adonai, which means master. So here he says, I am the Lord. And there's times that's enough. Just hearing that. What did David say in Psalm 46, verse 10? Be still and know that I am God. You know how many frustrations and how many doubts would pass away for the child of God if we would just simply be still and know that he is God, that he is firmly entrenched in his throne. There's no one that will ever overpower him, overtake him. That where he is seated and the kingdom over which he rules shall never be moved. And this is the king that we serve. This is the kingdom wherein we dwell. And he is the one who is overlooking us. He is the one who's watching after us. He is the one who is our protector. And so it is vital for the health of the mind of the child of God at times to just be still, put out all the turmoil, the commotion, the confusion, and just know that he's God. That's how he starts with Jeremiah. I am Jehovah, the God of all flesh, all living. He says, it's all of mine. It all belongs to me. And then he says, is there anything too hard for the Lord? Obviously, the question is rhetorical. There's nothing too hard for the Lord. Now, this isn't the first time that God asked that question. Genesis, the 18th chapter, when Sarah hears God tell Abraham, there in Genesis 18, remember, Abraham's in Mamre. He's sitting in the flap of the tent door, and three men approach him. You have theophany there. You have an appearance of God to Abraham, and then there's two angels. Those two angels end up going to Sodom. But God speaks with Abraham, and Sarah's in the tent. Sarah can hear the conversation. Have you ever stopped to think about that? I mean, all between Sarah and the voice of God, the voice of Jehovah, was nothing more than the fabric of a tent. That's amazing to think about. Here is Abraham talking to the Lord like a man would talk with his friend face to face. And God lets him know the time has come. They're going to have a child. And what does Sarah do? She laughs. I mean, I guess if my husband was 100 and I'm about 90, I'd laugh too. But, you know, it was only about 13 years prior, because at this time he's about 99, so because this is going to happen a little later, when he was 86, he had a son then with Hagar. So at that point he was still able. And if God was able to bless him at 86 to have a son, why couldn't he bless him at 100? So the Lord asked Sarah, is there anything too hard for the Lord? And she denied laughing, but we know she did. But anyway, is there anything too hard for the Lord? Now, obviously, they've been resting on this promise
I say resting, they've been at times trusting it, at times not, for now almost 25 years. And sometimes the promise of God seems long in coming. But when God now comes and says, the time's at hand, she laughs. And so God asks that question, is anything too hard for the Lord? Think about it in 1 Samuel chapter 14. In 1 Samuel chapter 14, the children of Israel are in this dire strait. There's only two swords in Israel. One's in the hand of Saul, and one's in the hand of Jonathan. They don't even have anybody in the land of Israel that can sharpen those swords. They've got to go to the Philistines even to sharpen their implements of warfare, but also their plows and so forth. The Philistines have so overtaken them that they have no way to defend themselves. Now, why did Israel want a king? When they came to Samuel, they wanted a king so, one, they could be like the other nations, but also that will fight our battles for us. Okay, you've got your king. Where is he at? He's at a place called Gibeah, sitting under a pomegranate tree, with a descendant of a relative of Ichabod. Ichabod was one of the grandsons of Eli, who, of course, predated Samuel. Why was he named Ichabod? Because we talked about here last Sunday about the Ark of the Covenant being taken from the children of Israel and that battle with the Philistines. When that child was born, as that all is going on, and he's named Ichabod, which means the glory of the Lord has departed. Now here is Saul, the king, sitting with an individual who's related to Ichabod. That ought to tell us his spiritual state of mind at the moment. Well, the glory of God's departed the place. What's the point? And so he's sitting up here far away from the battleground underneath a pomegranate tree taking his ease. Jonathan, though, that's not the case for him. Jonathan is surveying the situation. He's distressed that the children of Israel are sitting there impotent against the fear, the insults, and what might transpire. And so here's what he does. It came to pass upon a day, this is 1 Samuel chapter 14, that Jonathan the son of Saul said unto the young man that bare his armor, come and let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side. But he told not his father. This is really a reconnaissance mission. Now, he's going to go out, just him and this armor bearer, to kind of see, how is the Lord going to bless us? Is the Lord going to give the enemy into our hand? There's only two men, one of them with a sword, one's the armor bearer, and they're going to go in and see what's going to unfold. So it says, Saul tarried in the uttermost parts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron, and the people that were with him were about 600 men. And so you have Ahiah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, wearing an ephod. And the people knew not that Jonathan was gone. So here's Saul with the ephod. Should have been in a more spiritual place than he was, but he's not. He's got the priest. He's got the priest's garments there by his side, and he's sitting back doing nothing. But here you have Jonathan says, let us go over to the Philistines' garrison. Not just where there might be a handful of Philistines, but let's go. You know what a garrison is? I mean, it's their fort. That's where the army's all gathered together in one place. I mean, if I was going to attack, I don't think I'd go against the garrison. I'd try to pick them off one at a time as they go out to do something. That's not what Jonathan does. He says, we're going to go to their garrison. So one of two swords in all Israel is going to go over, and he's got his armor bearer. The armor bearer lets him know that, he says, do all that's in thine heart. I'm with thee. According to thy heart. You know, a lot of times that's exactly what the child of God needs, is a fellow laborer that is just as confident in the Lord as they are. Sometimes that's what we just need that. Their confidence feeds off of confidence. Well, anyway,
It says, between the passages by which Jonathan sought to go over under the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp rock on the one side and a sharp rock on the other side. And the name of the one was Bozez, and the name of the other was Sunam. The forefront of the one was situate northward over against Michmash, and the other southward over against Gibeah. So it's hard to try to envision this, but he's basically gone between very narrow rocks, but it's also a very safe place. Here he is between two mighty rocks, and he can kind of observe what's going on, but had he not had the faith to start out to begin with, he wouldn't have even found this place of safety. This, even though it's a difficult passage to get through, it's straight, it's difficult, it's also a very safe place to go. And so as he's observing what's going on, he can do so from a place of safety. But all that started because he trusted by faith that God would bless him to go over to the land or to the garrison of the Philistines. So off they go. And it says in verse 6, and Jonathan said to the young man that bear his armor, come and let us go over under the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be. Notice this. He doesn't say, I know this is going to happen without doubt. He doesn't say, well, we're done for. What's it matter? No, he said, It may be that the Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few. So the armor bearer says, do all this in thine heart, turn thee. Behold, I am with thee according to thy heart. Then said Jonathan, behold, we will pass over unto these men, and we will discover ourselves. That means we're going to tell them who we are. And if they say unto us, tarry until we come to you, then we will stand in our own place and will not go up to them. We know then that they have intent to come out and take our lives. He says, but if they say thus, come up unto us, then we will go up, for the Lord hath delivered them into our hand, and this shall be a sign unto us. So he tells the armor bearer, there's going to be one or two things said. They're either going to say, just wait there, we'll be there in a few minutes, and we know we better get out of here. On the other hand, if they say, come up, they invite us into their home, then we know the Lord's given them into our hands. Well, what happens? They tell the Philistines who they are. I wouldn't have done that. I would have tried to sneak in some way. But, I mean, this man, Jonathan, he's brazen and he's transparent. He doesn't try to trick them. He just says exactly who he is. They said, well, come on up. Now, I suspect they thought, we're going to get the king's son and we're either going to hold him ransom or we're going to take his life. But what they didn't know is the Lord had already given them into the hands of Jonathan. And so Jonathan goes with his armor bearer and slays in just a few moments' time and about a half acre of area, 20 men. And in the commotion of that battle, the Philistines grow confused and they think that the whole Israelite army has attacked them. So here you have one sword and an armor bearer and nothing else. But now God, just like he did as we saw last week with the Philistines when he discomfited them with the thunder out of heaven, now they're confused and they start killing each other. The enemy's killing the enemy. And the commotion of all of that is heard in the camp of Israel, and they began to take stock of who is missing, and they realize that Jonathan is gone. And so Saul finally comes to his wits. After he makes a stupid pledge that was unwise and not according to the will of God. Anyway, that's a story for another day. They finally go over and the Lord gives them a great victory that day. All that because one man is observing all this and says, you know what? I can stand here afraid like my father sitting up under the pomegranate tree. Or I can say, you know what? God can save by many or he can save by few. He just said there's nothing too hard for the Lord. That's what he's just expressed. And so the Lord gave the enemy into their hands. So back to Jeremiah 32. So the Lord tells Jeremiah, I am the Lord, the God of all flesh. Is there anything too hard for me? He says, I will give this city into the hand of the Chaldeans. That's set. And in the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and he shall take it. Said, that's all been talked about, Jeremiah. That's all been considered. It's been determined. And this is the way that it is. Verse 36, now therefore thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, concerning this city, whereof you say, it shall be delivered in the hand of the king of Babylon by the sword and by the famine and by the pestilence. Behold, I will gather them out of all countries, whither I have driven them in mine anger and in my fear and in great wrath, and I will bring them again unto this place. He says, yes, it's true. Right now they're dying by sword, by famine, by pestilence. This city is being given over into the hand of the Babylonians. He says, but here is the reality. He says, the day is coming that I'm going to bring them again to this place, and I will cause them to dwell safely. And they shall be my people, and I will be their God. I will give them one heart and one way that they may fear me forever. He says, for the good of them and of their children after them. And I will make an everlasting covenant with them that I will not turn away from them to do them good. And then as he comes down, verse 43, he says, and fields shall be bought in this land whereof ye say it is desolate, without man or beast. It is given under the hand of the Chaldeans. So he's just saying, what you've just done was a wise thing to do. And while it is true that some are going to say it's desolate, but fields will be bought, men shall buy fields for money and subscribe evidences and seal them and take witnesses in the land of Benjamin and in the places about Jerusalem and in the cities of Judah and in the cities of the mountains and the cities of the valley and in the cities of the south, for I will cause their captivity to return, saith the Lord. He just said, what you've just done is a token, it's a sign of the promise that the children of Israel are coming back. He says, they're not only going to buy land, they're not only going to buy property in Jerusalem. He says, but in the mountains, in the valleys, in all the cities of the south, he says, they're going to purchase again, they're going to buy, they're going to once again be restored to their place. Why? Because he asked, is there anything too hard for the Lord? It wasn't too hard for the Lord to give the city over to the Chaldeans. So it wasn't going to be too hard for the Lord to take the city from the Chaldeans and give it back to the Israelites, which is exactly what he did 70 years later. So as Jeremiah is watching all this unfold, you know, he's been prophesying it one thing, seeing it's another. And as he sees it, what's he say? Alas, oh no, see the mounds. Lord, you need to realize what's going on here. The Lord knew. Jeremiah, though, just was very shaky in his trust in the Lord at that moment, and we all get there. And even though we might say the right words, there's nothing too hard for thee. You made the heavens and the earth by thy mighty power and thy stretched out arm. We can say that and we ought to say it. But clearly it was not truly resonating in the soul of this prophet right then. So how does God respond? I am the Lord. I'm the Lord. The God of all flesh. Is anything too hard for me? It's better for us to just recognize that, not just intellectually, but to honor that in our emotions, in our soul. Let what we know in our mind also be the confidence of our heart, no matter what might be transpiring around us. Anybody would say, well, a besieged city being taken over, that would be reason to be concerned, certainly. But it's never a reason to doubt the ability or the love of the everlasting Jehovah. May God bless you, sir.